Sleep at time facts, paradoxes. Find a comfortable place where the day's edges can begin to soften. Let your breathing settle into its own slow rhythm. No effort needed. Your body already knows how to rest. It simply needs your permission. This is a book about paradoxes. Those quiet puzzles that philosophers have turned over for centuries. They sit at the boundary of clear thinking. Little knots that don't easily untie. Tonight, though, they are not problems to solve or arguments to win. They are more like patterns on a ceiling that you notice just before sleep. Almost familiar, slightly strange, entirely peaceful. They ask nothing of you. In the chapters ahead, we'll meet Zeno's endless race, Russell's careful set, and the ship that changes every plank. But right now, they are nothing but gentle companions, ideas that invite your mind to wander without gripping too tightly. Let your thoughts drift like a leaf on still water. The words are here. They will wait. And there is no hurry. Consider a single sentence printed plainly on a page. This statement is false. You can hold it in your mind for a moment. Let it settle. And then watch what happens. If the sentence is true, then what it says must be the case, namely, that it is false. So if it is true, it must be false. But if it is false, then what it says is not the case, meaning it is not false, so it must be true. The sentence curls back on itself, a small quiet loop with no resting point. There is no resolution, only the gentle back and forth that keeps going as long as you look at it. This little knot of language is ancient. One early shape of it appears in a story about Epimenides, a Cretan philosopher from the 6th or 7th century BCE. He is supposed to have said that all Cretans are liars. If he was telling the truth, then as a Cretan, he must have been lying, making the statement false. And if he was lying, then not all Cretans are liars, which leaves room for the statement to be false without immediate contradiction. So Epimenides' version is not quite the tight loop we have today. It can be untangled by supposing that some Cretans tell the truth, and Epimenides was simply wrong on that occasion. Still, the feeling of self-reference was there, and it intrigued later thinkers. A sharper form came from Eubulides of Miletus in the 4th century BCE. He asked simply, "A man says he is lying. Is he telling the truth?" This stripped away the escape route. When a speaker asserts his own falsehood, the two possibilities chase each other around in a circle. The ancient logicians, particularly the Stoics, took the problem seriously. Chrysippus is said to have written several books on the liar paradox, though none survive. We know they saw it as a challenge to the idea that every statement must be either true or false, a principle that seemed natural and firm. The paradox points to a fault line in our intuitive picture of truth. Everyday thinking treats truth as a property. A sentence has when it matches the world. But here, the sentence refers only to itself, and that self-involvement creates a kind of short circuit. It is not that the sentence is vague or ambiguous. Its meaning is perfectly clear. The trouble is that the standard rules for assigning truth break down when the assignment loops back on itself. This reveals that our ordinary concept of truth may not be as seamless as we assume. Logicians have responded in several careful ways. One approach, developed most influentially by Alfred Tarski in the 20th century, holds that a language cannot consistently contain its own truth predicate. That is, a sentence in a given language cannot talk about the truth of sentences in that same language without risking paradox. Tarski's solution builds a hierarchy. An object language talks about the world. A metalanguage talks about truth in the object language. A meta-metalanguage talks about truth in the metalanguage. And so on. The liar sentence, which tries to speak about its own truth, becomes ill-formed because it straddles levels it should not. The loop is broken by denying the sentence a place in the hierarchy. This is elegant, but it restricts the expressive power of language more than many philosophers find comfortable. Another response explores the idea of a truth value gap. Perhaps the liar sentence is neither true nor false. It falls into a third category, like a statement whose presupposition fails. If truth requires a grounding in something beyond the sentence itself, then a statement that refers only to its own truth might simply lack a footing, leaving it unassigned. This avoids contradiction, but it forces us to give up the principle that every well-formed declarative sentence must be true or false, which is a concession some are reluctant to make. A third direction rethinks the logic itself. In most logical systems, a statement and its negation cannot both be true, and a contradiction implies any conclusion. Paraconsistent logics relax that rule. They allow that the liar sentence might be both true and false, treating the contradiction as contained rather than explosive. This keeps the language whole and self-referential, but at the cost of revising deep assumptions about what a contradiction means. There are other paths too. Some philosophers focus on the way context shifts as we evaluate the sentence. Others notice that the paradox depends on the sentence referring successfully to itself, and they question whether self-reference of this sort is always achievable. Each response illuminates something, but none has settled the matter completely. The liar paradox remains an open country in logic and philosophy, a place where a simple sentence undoes a seemingly simple idea. As you let the sentence circle once more, this statement is false. Notice how little strain it takes to feel the loop. The mind can rest there, not solving it, just watching the movement. The sentence does not demand you fix it. It just sits there, turning quietly. A small reminder that some puzzles are more about the asking than the answering. A set, in the usual understanding, is just a collection of things. You can gather numbers, chairs, ideas, or even other sets. The rule for membership seems open-ended. Specify a condition, and the set contains exactly those items that satisfy it. The set of all red things, the set of all even numbers, the set of all sets that have more than three members. For decades, this generous principle guided the early work in set theory, and it felt natural. A set is defined by its condition. and any well-formed condition ought to pick out a set. Then in 1901, Bertrand Russell asked what happens when you let the condition be this. The set of all sets that do not contain themselves. Most sets do not contain themselves. The set of all teaspoons is not a teaspoon, so it does not belong to itself. The set of all even numbers is not an even number, so it stays outside. But now imagine collecting all such well-behaved sets into one new set. Call it R. The membership question for R is whether it contains itself. If it does, then it must meet the condition, meaning it does not contain itself. If it does not, then it fails the condition, meaning it must contain itself. The contradiction folds neatly in both directions. There is no escape. R belongs to itself exactly when it doesn't. Russell came upon this while studying the logical foundations of mathematics. The trouble was not a distant curiosity. Gottlob Frege, one of the most careful thinkers of the time, had spent years building a formal system meant to ground arithmetic in pure logic. His basic laws of arithmetic relied precisely on the unrestricted set-forming rule that Russell's construction undermined. When Russell wrote to him in June 1902, Frege had just finished the second volume. He added a short appendix, acknowledging the difficulty, beginning with the line, "A scientist can hardly meet with anything more undesirable than to have the foundations give way just as the work is finished." The simplicity of Russell's question had caused a genuine crack. The problem lives in that unrestricted comprehension principle. By allowing any condition to define a set, we invited conditions that refer to sets themselves in a looping way. Self-reference, when coupled with negation, so often produces this kind of spiral in daily life. Sentences like, "This statement is false," twist in a similar knot. But here the twist was inside the formal apparatus mathematicians used to talk about everything. If a system admits a contradiction, it becomes trivial in classical logic. Anything follows from a contradiction, so the discovery threatened to pull the whole structure apart. The response was not despair, but careful rebuilding. Russell himself worked on a theory of types, a hierarchy that forbids a set from being a member of itself by organizing objects into levels. A set can only contain items from a lower level. So a condition like "does not contain itself" becomes ill-formed. Others, notably Ernst Zermelo and later Abraham Frankel, built axiomatic set theory on restricted principles. They kept the useful operations of pairing, union, and power sets, while replacing unrestricted comprehension with separation. Given a set you already have, you can carve out the subset of its members that satisfy a condition. That way, a new set never reaches out to gather members from the entire universe of all possible things in a single reckless gesture. It stays local. The paradox also prompted a philosophical shift. We learned to distinguish between a collection and a condition, noticing that not every well-phrased description points to a completed whole. There is a gentleness in this insight, a language that felt perfectly general, actually, contained quiet limits, the move from intuitive gathering to careful axioms changed how logicians think about existence. To say a set exists, you need a bit more than a crisp definition. You need a construction that follows the rules. Russell's paradox endures as a kind of guardrail. It reminds anyone who works with formal systems that self-application can be delicate, and that the very tools we use to organize thought occasionally need their own boundaries drawn. The set of all sets that do not contain themselves does not exist in the rebuilt theory, and its absence is a small, quiet landmark along the road of modern logic. It points to the fact that even the most rigorous frameworks carry small seams, places where the fabric must be stitched with care. That care ended up producing a richer understanding of order, one that accommodates infinite collections and precise structure without giving way under a single curling question. Stand at one end of a room and pick a point on the far wall. Before you can arrive there, you must first cross half the distance. That part is easy to picture. Now, from that halfway mark, you must cross half of what remains, then half of that remainder, then half of that. The sequence never announces a last step, because after any fraction, no matter how small, there is still a remaining half waiting. Zeno of Elea, reasoning this way in the 5th century BCE, concluded that motion could never begin. The dichotomy is not a puzzle about running out of time or energy. It is a puzzle about the sheer number of tasks that seem to be packed into any short glide across a room. Walk through the argument slowly, and it feels almost hypnotic. Imagine the distance as a line of unit length. The first milestone sits at the midpoint, one half. The next sits at 3/4, then 7/8, then 15/16. The markers crowd together near the far end. Each step you might try to take brings you only to the next fraction in an unending list, because there are infinitely many such points between you and the door. Zeno claimed that covering them one by one would require an infinite number of distinct motions. An infinite number of motions, he thought, cannot be completed in a finite stretch of time. So the arrow never leaves the bow, and the foot never lifts from the floor. What makes the dichotomy linger is that the mathematical machinery we now bring to it seems, at first, to dissolve the problem cleanly. The distances Zeno asks us to traverse add up like this: 1/2 + 1/4 + 1/8 + 1/16, and so on without end. This is a geometric series, and its behavior was understood by later Greek mathematicians and formalized fully in the calculus. The partial sums approach 1, 1/2, 3/4, 7/8, 15/16. They creep arbitrarily close to the whole distance. The limit of the infinite sum is exactly 1. So far, all is smooth. The total distance is finite. A finite distance, you might say, requires only a finite time at a steady walking pace. The infinity of subdivisions seems tamed, yet that summation hides a subtle shift. Summing an infinite series in mathematics is a single conceptual operation. It does not instruct you to actually perform infinitely many separate acts of adding when you walk. You do not consciously tick off the halfway point, then the three-quarter point, then the seven-eighths point. The motion happens all at once. Zeno's challenge, though, was aimed at the very idea that you could finish a process whose parts never stop proliferating, even if the whole is finite. Can you really complete a journey made of endlessly many distinct subjourneys? The mathematical formula gives the sum. It does not provide a step-by-step method for physically visiting every point in order. Aristotle, who preserved Zeno's arguments for us, tried to untie the knot by distinguishing between a line and the points on it. He said that a continuous magnitude is not composed of indivisible points. The points exist only potentially, not as a completed infinity that you must exhaust. You can keep dividing a distance in thought, but the distance itself does not contain an actual infinite set of halfway markers waiting to block your way. Later thinkers refined this line of response. In modern terms, the real numbers between zero and one form a dense order. But traversing a continuum does not require enumerating them one after another. The motion is continuous, not a succession of discrete jumps to each midpoint. Even with these replies, the dichotomy refuses to become a mere solved exercise. It nudges us toward a peculiar fact about the everyday world. A single step, one that feels immediate and whole, contains within it an unbounded cascade of smaller intervals. No matter how close you are to the door, there is always a distance smaller than the one remaining, a fraction needing to be crossed before the next. The infinite does not shout here. It sits quietly beneath the floorboards, harmless and strange. As you turn the light out and let the thought drift, what remains is the image of that soft, uncompleted line of markers, endlessly fine, waiting in a space that takes no effort at all to cross. A swift runner and a slow tortoise, side by side at the start of a dusty track. Achilles, the great hero of the Greeks, offers the tortoise a friendly head start. The tortoise accepts and begins to crawl forward. Achilles waits, patient and confident. When the tortoise has moved 100 paces, the race begins. Achilles runs smoothly, his strides eating up the ground. In a moment, he reaches the spot where the tortoise started, but the tortoise is no longer there. In the small time it took Achilles to cover those 100 paces, the tortoise has moved another 10. So Achilles must now run those 10 paces. He does effortlessly. When he arrives at the new point, the tortoise has advanced a little farther, perhaps a single pace this time. Again, Achilles covers that distance. And again, the tortoise has crept ahead by a small amount. This continues, the gap shrinking, but never quite vanishing. The argument says that Achilles can never overtake the tortoise. Each time he arrives at a place where the tortoise has been, the creature has already departed for somewhere new. There will always be another small distance to cover, another interval of time before the next arrival. The chase breaks into an unending sequence of stages, and completing an endless sequence seems to require an endless duration. On its face, this is absurd. We know a fast runner overtakes a slow one every time. Yet the logic feels tight. The structure closely resembles Zeno's dichotomy, where crossing a room requires first crossing half, then half of the remaining half, and so on. Here, instead of having a fixed distance, the steps shrink according to the relative speeds of the two racers. If Achilles runs 10 times as fast as the tortoise, the first leg is 100 paces, the next 10, the next one, and on it goes. The mathematical reply emerged in clearer form long after Zeno. The distances Achilles must run form a geometric series. 100, 10, 1, 1/10, 1/100, and so forth. Add them all up, and the total is not infinite. It is exactly 111 1/9 paces. At that spot, Achilles finally draws level with the tortoise. The times needed for each segment form a similar shrinking series, an infinite number of time intervals sums to a finite duration. So the chase does have an end, and it arrives within a finite stretch of time. Once this is pointed out, the paradox can feel almost like a trick of faulty bookkeeping. Zeno asked us to picture an endless list of tasks, but an endless list can have a finite sum. Just as the fraction 1/3 unfolds, as 0.3 repeated forever, without passing a fixed boundary, the mathematics of limits, developed centuries later by Newton and Leibniz, gave precise tools for handling such infinite sequences. Yet for some, the deeper philosophical tangle remains. The mathematical sum describes a limit. But does it describe the actual completion of a supertask? An infinite number of separate actions, one after another. If each stage of the chase is a distinct event, then the runner would have to perform an unlimited number of catch-up acts. Whether physical motion can be carved into infinitely many discrete parts is a question that continues to draw careful argument. One response holds that motion is fundamentally continuous, not chopped into separate little advances. Another suggests that at the limit, the infinite sequence collapses into a single smooth passage. These finer debates need not disturb the gentle image of the race. Picture the scene softening now. The bright track fades at the edges. Achilles's strides blur into a steady rhythm, and the tortoise's slow shuffle becomes a quiet, regular pulse. The gap between them shrinks to a sliver, then a speck, then something too small to hold in the mind's eye. The infinite steps fold themselves into a single fleeting moment. The race does not reach its finish here. The finish is simply allowed to dissolve. The runner and the tortoise drifting out of the frame before the overtaking ever occurs. An arrow is released from the bowstring and lifts into a quiet arc. For a moment, if you could freeze the world, you would see it suspended against the sky, perfectly still in that single slice of time. Zeno of Elea, writing in the 5th century before the Common Era, asked us to consider that frozen moment and then to think about what it really contains. The arrow paradox runs like this. At any indivisible instant of its flight, the arrow occupies a space exactly equal to its own length. It is not larger than that space, nor smaller. It fits it precisely if something occupies a space equal to itself. It is what we call at rest at that one instant. Nothing about the arrow's position is changing. Now time, Zeno supposed, is composed entirely of such indivisible instants, arranged one after another. If at every instant the arrow is at rest, and time is nothing but instants, then the arrow is always at rest. Motion, he concluded, cannot happen. The logical steps are gentle, but they tighten around a genuine difficulty. The word instant does the heavy lifting. An instant is supposed to have no duration. It is a point in time, not a stretch of it, in a durationless point. No change can occur because change requires a before and an after. So if you try to catch the arrow in the act of moving inside an instant, you fail. The instant is too narrow to hold motion. All it can hold is a location. The arrow paradox becomes a meditation on what time must be like if it can contain movement at all. One long-standing reply is that motion is not the sort of thing that exists inside an instant. An instant is merely a boundary, like the edge of a ruler marking, where 1 centimeter ends and the next begins. You would not say that length lives at the boundary. Motion lives across intervals. The arrow moves when at one moment it is here, and at a later moment it is there. The motion itself is a fact about the relationship between those two moments, not a property that any single moment possesses. In this view, being at rest is also a property that needs an interval. Something is at rest if over a stretch of time its position does not alter. So Zeno's claim that the arrow is at rest at each instant might already be mistaken, because rest, like motion, requires duration. Mathematicians and physicists later offered a more refined version of this idea. Using the tools of calculus, they defined instantaneous velocity not as something that occurs at a literal isolated point, but as the limit of average velocities over smaller and smaller intervals around that point. The arrow's speed at an instant is a number that summarizes how its position changes when you zoom in on the timeline. It exists as a mathematical convenience, a description of a tendency, not a snapshot of activity. The arrow is moving because its trajectory is smooth, and its position function has a derivative. Even with these clarifications, the paradox retains a stubborn appeal. Some philosophers point out that the language of limits and derivatives explains how we can model motion successfully, but it does not fully dissolve the conceptual puzzle. The feeling that there is a jump between a sequence of stationary positions and genuine movement is hard to shake. A film strip is a collection of still frames. Yet, when projected, it creates the illusion of motion. Is reality like that? If time really were built from durationless slices, would the arrow's flight be any more than a succession of quiet, motionless tableaus? These are open questions, and they lie at the edge of what physics and logic can comfortably say. There is a serene image that emerges from thinking about Zeno's arrow. Picture the arrow halfway along its path, held in a moment of thought. The air around it is still. The fletching does not quiver. The point is utterly fixed. This single instant, if it could be examined, would contain almost nothing of the flight, except a silent, perfect location. The paradox invites you to rest with that image, not to solve it urgently, but to notice how strange it is that so many of these quiet points, placed side by side, add up to the rushing arc we see when we let go of the bow. The arrow paradox does not threaten our daily experience of motion. Arrows still reach their targets, yet it leaves behind a gentle puzzlement about the structure of time. It asks whether the flowing river of moments can be made from drops that, taken alone, are entirely dry. You can put the question down and pick it up again whenever you like. The still arrow will be there, waiting in the same instant, inviting you to wonder. Start with a single grain of sand resting in the palm of an imagined hand. No one would look at that one small grain and call it a heap. A heap of sand is something larger, something substantial. Add a second grain, still not a heap. A third, no chain. The transition from not heap to heap never arrives in a single step, because one grain seems powerless to cross that line. If one grain cannot create a heap, and you begin with something that is definitely not a heap, then no matter how many grains you add one by one, you never reach a heap. That is the current of the Sarait's paradox. Flowing quietly from a few innocent-looking premises to a conclusion that cannot be right. The word Sarait's comes from the Greek word for a pile or heap, and the paradox was known to the logicians of antiquity. The puzzle is not really about sand. It is about concepts whose boundaries have no crisp edge. Once you state the reasoning clearly, it applies to any gradual change. A man with a full head of hair is not bald. Pluck one hair, and he still is not bald. If no single hair loss transforms the non-bald into the bald, then by this step-by-step reasoning, a man will never become bald, even after every hair is gone. The same pattern repeats for tallness. Someone who is 5 feet tall is not tall. Adding a millimeter cannot make the difference between short and tall in one instant. Yet we are perfectly comfortable calling some people tall and others not. The paradox pushes us to ask what we mean when we use these everyday words. The argument works because of a logical principle that seems hard to deny. The principle says that if a small change does not alter the application of a word, then repeated small changes also cannot alter it. Step by tiny step, you move from a clear case where the word does not apply to a clear case where it does. And the logical structure forces you to say the word never applies. But the real world clearly contains heaps of sand, bald men, and tall people. So something must give. Philosophers have offered three broad kinds of reply. The first accepts that there is, somewhere, a sharp boundary. One grain does make the difference between a heap and a non-heap. But we simply cannot know which grain it is. The boundary exists, hidden from our ordinary awareness. This answer preserves the neatness of classical logic, because the statement, "This is a heap," can be sharply true or false for every number of grains. The trouble is that it leaves us with a fact that feels both arbitrary and unknowable. If the thousandth grain made the heap, why not the 999th? And how could our word for heap latch onto a precise number that no language user can identify? A second response softens the idea of truth. Instead of true and false as an all-or-nothing switch, we can speak of degrees of truth. A collection of two grains is hardly a heap at all. So the proposition, "This is a heap," is almost entirely false. A collection of 200 grains is more heap-like. The proposition is true to a high degree. As the grains accumulate, the truth value slides upward, like a dimmer switch rather than a click. This fuzzy logic approach captures the gradual feel of vague language. It explains why we never find a single grain that makes the difference. No grain does, because the transition is spread out across many grains. Critics worry, though, that the machinery of degrees gets complicated quickly when we combine statements. If this is a heap, is 0.7 true? What is the truth of this is a heap? And that is a heap when the second pile is 0.6 true. The exact numbers feel as artificial as the sharp boundary. The third kind of reply challenges the logical step itself. It denies that if one grain cannot change a non-heap into a heap, then an endless series of such grain additions also cannot do so. This reply uses a form of reasoning called supervaluationism. On this view, a statement is true if it comes out true on every acceptable way of making the vague term precise. For borderline cases, the statement is neither true nor false. It is indeterminate. One grain cannot be the turning point, is true for each particular grain you check. But it does not follow that there is no heap, because the phrase turning point has different reference depending on how you sharpen the word. The logic of vagueness on this view demands a departure from simple two-valued reasoning. The appeal is that it keeps the ordinary truth of clear cases while allowing a genuine fuzziness in the middle. One can get a feel for the paradox by watching a mental image, a flat surface, and onto it grains of sand descend slowly, one by one. At first, a few scattered specks, then a light dusting, then a small mound begins to lift from the flatness. The concept of a heap does not snap into focus at some countable instant. It coalesces like the edge of twilight, or like the borderland between being awake and being somewhere else entirely, where the contours of awareness soften. The heap was never in the grains themselves. It was a pattern our mind traced across them. The Saurite's paradox invites us to notice the gentle blur at the edges of our own categories, and to sit with that blur without demanding a sharper line than the world provides. Plutarch told the story first. Theseus, the mythical king of Athens, sailed a ship back from Crete after defeating the Minotaur. The people of Athens kept that ship in their harbor as a memorial. And as the years passed, they would replace its planks one by one, each time a piece of wood weakened. Eventually, every plank, every nail, every length of rope had been swapped for new material. The question arose quietly, almost as a pastime. after all those replacements, was the vessel still the ship of Theseus? The puzzle feels gentle at first. A wooden ship is a physical thing. So if the physical parts change gradually, maybe the thing itself remains. That is how we talk about ordinary objects. A bicycle with a new wheel is still your bicycle, but push a little further. If all the matter is different, what is it that persists? Is it the shape, the function, the name, or the continuous history of replacement? The old planks did not vanish. Imagine that a careful shipwright gathered every discarded piece and reassembled them exactly as they had been, restoring the original ship with its weathered timber and faded paint. Now there are two candidates. One has the continuous history. The other has the original material. The problem sharpens into a single question. Which one is the ship of Theseus? Thomas Hobbes tightened the dilemma in the 17th century. He imagined a second ship built from the original planks, and then asked whether the original ship had persisted in the continuously maintained vessel or in the reassembled planks. If you believe the answer cannot be both, you face a choice. Neither choice is obviously absurd, and neither satisfies completely. The continuously maintained ship went through an uninterrupted life of repairs, but it lost its original substance. The reassembled ship regained its substance, but its history was interrupted. Philosophers have responded in several broad ways. One approach says that objects are four-dimensional things that extend across time as well as space. On this view, the ship is not a three-dimensional object that lasts through time, but a four-dimensional entity that has temporal parts. The continuously maintained ship and the reassembled ship are two different temporal slices that share an earlier moment. The original ship just is that earlier stretch of the four-dimensional worm, and the later candidates branch off from it. There is no deep puzzle, only a question about which branch we choose to call by the old name. A contrasting view is that identity for material objects is not a precise fact of the world, but a matter of how we decide to use words. We sort things into kinds, and for each kind, we have fuzzy rules about what counts as the same thing over time. For a ship, practical continuity may weigh more heavily than original matter. For a painting, the original canvas and pigment might matter more. On this account, the ship of Theseus' riddle is not a mystery waiting to be solved, but a sign that the concept of sameness has slack in it. Slack that ordinary talk leaves untied. When the puzzle is shifted to persons, the same questions reappear in softer form. Your body replaces its cells gradually over years. Your memories shift. Your habits evolve. If every part of you is eventually replaced, are you the same person you once were? Here the discussion often turns to psychological continuity. The thread of memory and personality that links one moment to the next. That thread, rather than the material, is what many philosophers have placed at the center of personal identity. Yet the ship of Theseus reminds us that continuous psychological change is still change, and the self you were 10 years ago might be connected to you now by a chain of small adjustments, each one unremarkable, together, a quiet transformation. There is also the simple thought, defended by some, that the question has no fact of the matter answer. It is not that the answer is hidden, but rather that the situation is underdescribed, the ship after repair, and the ship from old planks each have a claim, and nothing in the world decides between them besides the conventions we bring on still nights that may be the most calming response of all. Some riddles are not storms to be mastered, but patterns to be observed and then set aside. The ship sits in the harbor, half old, half new, never quite the same from one wave to the next. The planks that were replaced yesterday are already drying in the sun, ready to be fitted again. Imagine a room with two boxes. One box is clear, and inside it you can see $1,000. The other box is opaque, and you cannot see what it holds. It might contain $1,000,000, or it might contain nothing at all. A being with a remarkable talent for prediction has already made a choice about what to place in the opaque box. This being, often called the predictor, has played this game with many people before. Its record is nearly perfect. When a person chose both boxes, the predictor nearly always left the opaque box empty. When a person chose only the opaque box, the predictor nearly always filled it with $1,000,000. The prediction was made before you enter the room, and the contents of the boxes are now fixed. You know all this. Now you must decide. Do you take both boxes, or do you take only the opaque one? The puzzle was introduced by the physicist William Newcomb, and later brought into wider discussion by the philosopher Robert Nozick. It has since become a quiet fault line in decision theory. Two lines of reasoning lead to opposite conclusions, and each one feels like simple common sense. The first line says you should take only the opaque box. The reasoning runs like this. The predictor is almost always right. People who take only the opaque box walk away millionaires. People who take both boxes almost always get just the $1,000 from the clear box. If you want the million, you should act like the kind of person the predictor foresees, choosing one box. More formally, expected utility theory tells you to weigh the possible outcomes by how likely they are. The probability that the opaque box is full, given that you take only it, is very high. The probability that it is empty, given that you take both boxes, is also very high. So the expected value of one boxing is close to $1,000,000, while the expected value of two boxing is close to $1,000, even though the money is already in the boxes or not. Your decision seems to indicate what is already there. Many decision theorists find this reasoning persuasive. Then there is the second line, which says you should take both boxes. Its argument is just as clear and just as hard to dismiss. The predictor has already acted. The money is either sitting in the opaque box or it is not. Nothing you do now can change that. If the opaque box is full, then taking both boxes gets you the million plus $1,000. If it is empty, taking both boxes gets you $1,000 instead of nothing. Either way, taking both boxes leaves you $1,000 richer than taking only the opaque box. This is the dominance principle. When one option is better, no matter how the world turns out, rationality seems to demand it. Two boxing dominates one boxing. The past is fixed, and so is the contents of the boxes. So the choice should be for both. Every time, here the puzzle splits the mind. Both arguments cannot be right. Yet both appear unassailable from within their own perspective. The one boxer sees a clear connection between your choice and the likely state of the world, a connection that acts through the predictors for knowledge. The two boxer sees a straightforward independence between a choice made now and an event already settled in the past. Much of the quiet debate around this problem turns on how we think about free will and foreknowledge. If the predictor can know your choice in advance with near certainty, does that mean your choice was already determined? And if it was, does that alter what it means to choose rationally? Some philosophers see the problem as a gentle way to test our intuitions about causal loops and backward influence. The predictor's foresight does not cause your choice, but it correlates so perfectly that the usual boundaries between past and future seem to soften. There is no settled resolution. Decision theorists remain divided. Some have tried to break the puzzle by proposing that the predictor is logically impossible under certain views of free will. Others have argued that the mere act of describing the problem commits us to one answer or the other. But for most people who encounter it, the problem lingers as a kind of mental lullaby. The two arguments sit side by side, equally calm, equally reasonable, each as inviting as the other. And in that quiet space, the idea of a simple choice, one box or two, expands into something vast and unresolved. The way a dream can feel perfectly logical until you wake and try to hold it. A teacher stands before a class and makes a simple announcement. There will be an examination next week. She says, on one of the 5 weekdays, you will not know which day until you arrive that morning. The exam will be a surprise. The students listen, and after the teacher leaves, a quiet conversation begins. Someone points out that the exam cannot possibly be on Friday. The reasoning is straightforward. If Thursday night arrives and the exam has not yet happened, then only Friday remains. At that point, the day would be known in advance and the surprise would vanish. So Friday is impossible. With Friday ruled out, the same logic slides backward. Consider Thursday. If Wednesday night passes with no exam, then only Thursday and Friday are left. But Friday has already been shown to be impossible. That leaves only Thursday. Once again, knowing it must be Thursday removes the surprise. So Thursday cannot work either. The students continue, step by step, eliminating Wednesday, then Tuesday, then Monday. By the end, no day remains. The exam cannot happen at all. The announcement appears to be a contradiction. A few days pass. On Wednesday morning, the teacher walks in with a stack of papers. The students blink. They did not expect the exam that day. It is, in fact, a complete surprise. The paradox is that their careful reasoning, which seemed to prove no surprise was possible, has just been defeated by a real event. The logic was persuasive, yet the world paid it no mind. This puzzle has been discussed since at least the 1940s, often called the unexpected hanging paradox, or the surprise examination. It belongs to a family of problems about self-referential knowledge and the effort to reason about what other people know and what they know that you know. The student's argument depends on a chain of deductions that assumes each link holds with the same certainty, but the later links, especially those about Thursday and Friday, rest on a particular assumption, that the students will still believe the exam is coming on those later days, and that they will still accept their own earlier reasoning. As the week unfolds, their epistemic state changes. On Monday morning, the students do not know the day, even if their deduction about Friday is sound in some abstract sense. It is a deduction made from a vantage point they have not yet reached. The world on Monday contains four remaining possibilities. The surprise condition only requires that, on the evening before the exam, the students cannot be certain it will come the next day, as long as they cannot uniquely pick out the correct day from the set of remaining days. The condition holds. The backward induction tries to collapse that set prematurely by importing a certainty that only exists at the end of the week into the beginning. Some philosophers have suggested that the paradox exposes a hidden tension in how we handle iterated knowledge. For the Friday step to work, the students must know on Thursday night that they have survived the week so far, and they must know that the teacher's announcement was true. But is their own memory of the announcement something they can trust with absolute certainty? Might they wonder, even slightly, whether they misheard or whether the exam was canceled? Real reasoning includes such tiny grains of doubt, and the formal deduction often ignores them. Another angle turns on what the teacher means by surprise. If she simply means that the students will not be able to deduce the day in advance using formal logic, then their failed deduction might be part of the point. Their reasoning is self-defeating. By concluding that no surprise is possible, they ensure that the exam, when it comes, will indeed be unexpected. The student's argument also relies on common knowledge. They assume that everyone in the class accepts the rules, that everyone knows everyone else accepts them, and so on without any fuzzy edge. But common knowledge is a fragile thing. A single student who harbors a private doubt about the whole chain can break the reasoning, and the collective certainty may not be as solid as it seems. In the end, the surprise examination paradox does not announce a verdict. It simply lays out a sequence of thoughts and lets you notice where the gears begin to slip. You can sit with it, letting the logic unspool forward and backward, watching how a faultless-looking proof can collide with an ordinary Wednesday morning. Where exactly the proof goes wrong remains a question with more than one gentle answer. Imagine a hotel with no last room. The hallway stretches on and on, door after identical door, and wherever you stand, the corridor does not end. David Hilbert, the mathematician who proposed this thought experiment in a 1924 lecture, used it to show how strangely the infinite behaves when we try to treat it like an ordinary number. The hotel is full. every room has a guest, a weary traveler arrives at the front desk and asks for a room in a finite hotel, the answer would be a gentle apology. But here the manager simply nods, picks up the telephone, and asks the guest in room 1 to move to room 2. The guest in room 2 to move to room 3. And so on. Each occupant shifts over by one. Room 1 stands empty, and the newcomer settles in. The hotel is still full, but a new person has been accommodated. Infinity plus 1 is still infinity. The trek deepens. A bus pulls up carrying not one extra person, but a countably infinite number of them. As many as there are natural numbers. The manager does not panic. He asks each existing guest to move from room N to room 2N. The person in room 1 goes to room 2. Room 2 goes to room 4. Room 3 to room 6. All the even-numbered rooms are now occupied, and all the odd-numbered rooms stand open. The manager can then assign each new arrival to an odd room. First person from the bus to room 1. Second to room 3. Third to room 5. And onward, the hotel absorbs them all, even though it had no vacancies a moment ago. Then the situation becomes even more layered. An endless fleet of buses arrives, each bus carrying its own infinite set of passengers. The buses are numbered, and the seats inside each bus are numbered too. It seems as if the hotel must finally run out of room, but the manager spreads a chart across the desk, a grid where every bus forms a row and every seat a column. He draws a path that visits each pair exactly once, a careful zigzag. First bus, first seat, first bus, second seat, second bus, first seat, first bus, third seat, second bus, second seat, third bus, first seat, and so on. The path works its way through the entire grid without missing anyone. He assigns each visited pair to a room number in the order he reaches them. And once again, the hotel swallows up all the newcomers. The key is that every passenger can be mapped to a unique, natural number. The manager has proved that an infinite collection of infinite groups is still, in a precise sense, the same size as the natural numbers themselves. This is where the idea of cardinality enters, soft as a footnote. Two sets have the same cardinality if their elements can be paired off one to one. The natural numbers have the smallest infinite cardinality, usually called aleph null. Hilbert's hotel shows that adding one, or a finite number, or even an infinite number of new guests to a set of size, aleph null, does not produce a larger set. A part of an infinite set can be exactly as large as the whole, which is a departure from our everyday experience of finite collections. The paradox is not a contradiction in mathematics. It is a demonstration that the rules for finite quantities do not carry over into the infinite. Once you accept the definition of cardinality, the strange behavior becomes a natural consequence, something to smile at rather than worry over. The image that stays is a soft one, an endless hallway of closed doors. Each shift of a guest, a quiet step deeper into an idea. Not a problem to solve, but a landscape to wander. The doors never stop, and the mind, relaxing, does not need to count them. It simply notices that the corridor extends, that a new room is always waiting, and that the notion of full is not as fixed as it first seemed. The numbers go on, and so does the quiet. The night itself has a riddling shape, the mind that followed a sentence, looping back on itself, can now let that same loop become a cradle. The set of all sets that do not contain themselves no longer tugs at attention. It merely hums, a distant, tidy puzzle that can wait until morning. Even the hotel with its endless corridors of even and odd numbers softens into the image of a door that opens onto sleep, and then another, each one quieter than the last. There is a kind of sorites in the way wakefulness fades. No single grain of thought marking the shift from one state to the next. The ship of the self reassembled plank by plank with every exhale drifts without needing to ask whether it is still the same vessel. And time, which Zeno divided into halves that never quite arrived, now does the gentlest thing. It suspends its chase. The breath draws a slow arc. That is enough. The paradoxes stay, but they ask nothing. They simply keep watch, light as logic can be. While the last thought dissolves into the pleasant blank, where all of it rests,